The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, ladies and gents, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm your host and narrator, Eric Peabody. In good old Western New York, we've hit the part of winter that I affectionately call deep hurting. I'm a California lad, and by this point in the season, I'm sick of the snow, sick of the cold, and sick of the ice. And wouldn't you know it, I've also caught a bug. Tonight's episode will be slightly shorter than usual to accommodate the aforementioned deep hurting, but it's suitably bleak for the oppressive environs that we find ourselves in. When you need a tale that hits hard and leaves you wondering why the hell we even wake up in the morning, who better to turn to than J.R. Hamantaschen? The story is titled, Love is Not an Eternal Thing Like Hatred or Disgust, and with it being as brief as it is, I'll forego the usual synopsis. But this one kept turning in my mind for a while after reading it, gnawing away like a worm in an apple. Please join me as we journey through the grim landscape of our eventual demise. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, please do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author J.R. Hamantaschen, I give you, Love is not an eternal thing like hatred or disgust. Given everything that happened, I find myself thinking quite often about that conversation I had with that old man outside the grocery store. How could I not? Everyone has their similar, last normal conversation they think about, I'm sure. I don't want to make it sound too important or anything, but, well, I think about it a lot. I was in the parking lot collecting shopping carts, which was my favorite job at the grocery store because I got to chill outside. You could really take your time out there. The runner-up job was stocking shelves, but only when you were left alone long enough to reach that trance-like flow state. But that was pretty rare, because doesn't everyone need to ask the guy stocking shelves in the cookie aisle where the oxtail or cottage cheese might be? This has got me thinking about all these things I miss about the store. I used to complain about how much the job sucked, but really, if it paid better and was better respected, I would have loved it. I kind of miss when people would speak to me and either be pleasantly surprised I spoke English, confused that I didn't speak Spanish, or, less common but not unheard of, disappointed I didn't speak Hindi. I miss manning the register when a cute girl was checking out. Our slang was doing a double checkout, if you get my meaning, and I think you do. Sometimes I'd offer a pretty girl a chocolate bar or something on the house, and just that little proactivity would give me a confidence boost. I mean, who can turn down free chocolate? Though, knowing my manager, Omar, had this paternalistic thing where he was silently rooting for me to interact more with women to gain some confidence, dissuaded me from ever trying it. It made me feel so awkward and pathetic, thinking of my middle-aged manager spying on me in the wings, being like, "Go after it, son." And one time, after I did the candy bar thing, he hummed "Candy Shop," and the only response to that is requesting an eject button be installed behind the register. But there's no point in thinking about all that now. Anyway, that conversation with the old man. I'd finished getting the grocery carts and was heading back to the front entrance when I saw him, standing far enough away from the entrance to know he wasn't planning on going in. As I passed him, I gave him the nod. You know, that friendly nod just acknowledging someone's existence. He didn't nod back, not really. But it's not like he ignored me either. It's hard to explain. Even though he was standing still, I could tell he was internally shuffling, like he was nervous or distraught, as if he was preoccupied with something. "Everything okay?" I asked him. It's not like he snapped to attention or anything, but my question seemed to center him. I remember he was fidgety, touching and adjusting himself here and there, hand wiping invisible sweat off the back of his neck, rubbing the back of his hands, sniffling. He looked around, like taking a survey of the big wide world, before answering me. "I'm okay," he said. He didn't convince me, or himself. He looked like he had the weight of the universe on his shoulders and was attempting to perform what was expected of him, that old person routine of not being a bother. It's hard to tell how old an old person is, and not to sound racist about it, but especially an old pale white guy. If I had to guess, I'd say maybe 70s, but sometimes you meet someone in their 70s and you think, damn, that person's still with it, like the retired and traveling the world type of 70s. This guy was more like the type of 70s the people used to look like back in the 1950s. Worn, creased, spent. That's the word, spent. Not to be all crass, but ever read online that theory about cum being like a vital or sacred fluid or any of that bullshit? Well, he looked like all his vital and sacred juices had run dry. That's for damn sure. "Okay, are you sure?" I was just saying friendly words because, well, I like to think I'm a nice guy. And there's always that added little touch of work professionalism, like I've internalized the idea of Omar actually watching over me and being proud of me. My simple question must have touched him in some way, because I won't forget what he said, or how he looked when he said it. His mouth and eyes quivered, as if trying to collect himself, keep the facade up. And in that struggle, out came, in a feeble, kind of desperate croak, "I'm old." It came out like the misjudged punchline to a joke no one asked to hear. And then he kind of smiled in embarrassment, looked away, and put his hand to his face. It was as if he was trying to take back what he'd just said, snatch it out of existence and shove it back inside himself. All the sorrow in the world, like it couldn't just be expressed in a normal way, but somehow he had to atone for the sin of laying it out before me. Like he expressed some truth which couldn't be fully comprehended. "I'm sorry," he said next, but the bell couldn't be unrung. "It's okay," I said, not sure where to go next with this, and honestly just kind of wishing I kept my mouth shut. I guess I expected him to say something else, like stuff old people usually say about getting older or being old, stuff like beats the alternative or something like that. "Getting old's what we all have to look forward to," I said instead, just blabbing. I meant it in a good way. He smiled, wanly. "I bet you have a lot of stories." He didn't say anything, tried to keep the same brave face, but it was like I could see right through it. What he was really thinking was, none of that matters. I was hoping to be able to segue into the usual, "well, if you need anything," type of filler, but he seemed so shaken, like maybe there had been some small chance that he could convince himself that everything was still okay, but that chance was now good and dead. Like he'd internally just gotten the message, "Yep, it's terminal. You're stuck with this." Stuck with me, this lazy 19-year-old fuck-up asshole who just recently begun the 13th grade, aka community college, because he'd had the bright idea to take a year off to figure his shit out, and figuring his shit out meant working at a grocery store. "Do you have family?" I was trying to find out if he needed me to call someone.
"I was one of 5 children, 3 of us still around. I have 3 children myself, 7 grandchildren, if you can believe it."
That got him back into the kindly old person automated response feedback loop, almost. Ask about family, children, yada yada. "Oh wow, that's great," I said, to be supportive, keeping things frictionless.
"It is, isn't it?"
That last clause, a groping plea.
"Yes, I've been blessed with a great family."
But his face, he didn't need to say it. It was almost as if he wasn't even trying anymore. His focus was elsewhere. He'd tried with the bland reassurances, the usual, "What more could I ask for?" bullshit. But it was like he respected my intelligence to not continue with the performance. It was as if him being elderly, a truly old person, meant we were speaking the same language, but we couldn't understand each other. Or, more accurately, I wasn't absorbing what he was saying, not fully, not deeply. It was like he was shackled in a way I couldn't understand, and had no real incentive to understand, really. Because who wants to? I felt a sort of shame during all of this, because I've always found the elderly kind of repulsive. Not in any special way. I imagine much the same way as other people do.
"It started when I lost any interest in sex. You know, that was so much of your life as a young man, is thinking about sex. When that goes..."
You could forgive me, but when an elderly man begins to talk about sex, you have permission to leave. "I know, right?" I said, nonsensically.
"Well, if you need anything..." "The world is changing, isn't it? I mean, the people who live here. Not the way people are. That doesn't ever change,"
I heard him say as I made my way back to work, leaving him that hoary stereotype, the old man muttering to himself. I thought of telling security to check on him to make sure he was okay, but I didn't want an incident, or for them to not understand and do something stupid. I looked out at him a few minutes later and saw him from the back, still standing there, face buried in his hands, but it wasn't like he was crying. His back wasn't going up and down in hysterics or anything. I put the stuff down that I was holding and went outside to check on him myself. To do what, I'm not sure. Maybe console him, but he turned and gave me a kindly wave off, as if to say, "I appreciate it, but I got this." I got closer, with my hand up to acknowledge I got the message. He probably didn't want to be a bother, be a dependent. I just wanted to show that I was looking out for him. "Okay, sir. Have a good day. Nice talking to you. If you need me to call anyone, please let me know." His face faltered in a way I can't quite describe. I can't say why, but I can guess. Maybe it's because when I approached him, he expected something more, maybe more of a human connection. But then I just offered trite babble in a professional send-off.
"You're a good boy," he said.
"Thanks." I kept a straight face, concealing the secondhand embarrassment of that out-of-fashion description. A good boy, like I'm a dog or something. But I got it. He's old. He can't be blamed for being well-meaning but awkward. It's like when you hear "Bustin' Makes Me Feel Good" during the Ghostbusters song. It's like, just so fucking bizarrely off. He shuffled away, and I can't describe it, but I felt like I fucked up somehow. Like there was that rare chance of, I don't want to use the word intimate, but something like understanding or connection. And it was either the phrasing or the timing or just the difference in age or something, but something got lost. I feel guilty about it. Not just for the obvious, but for everything that happened next. I know, it's not my fault. I know, I'm speculating. I don't need to explain much about what happened next. You know generally what happened. You're still living through it. Just like me, just like everyone. Though maybe telling you what happened to me might make some other things make more sense. About 30 minutes later, I was back to stocking shelves in the international section. I should specify, one of the many, many international sections in our store. It must have been the Mediterranean one. An elderly Middle Eastern man was with what I assumed was his family, and he was obsessing over the honey, of all things. He had one of those kufi hats on, which I remember because I always thought those looked cool. Omar, who, if you've forgotten, was my manager, wore them sometimes, and kufi's fun to say. There was a man and a woman with him, and something made me think he was the man's father, and they had three little kids with them, something like aged 5, 3, and the youngest an infant in a stroller. I'm just guessing because I'm not good with baby ages. This old guy was going through all the honeys, I remember, and you could tell the woman was getting annoyed but suppressing it, as it seemed like the childcare duties were all hers and she wasn't too thrilled about the arrangement. The older guy was really taking this honey business too seriously. She was giving what I assumed was her husband a sly, nasty look, although he was occupied with some other bullshit. I remember the old guy was holding a bottle of Al-Shifa Grade A. I remember because that's probably the best honey we have, and I was kind of invested in this honey fixation, him going through each one for no discernible reason. Unless he'd been enslaved by sentient bees, there was no reason for him to take this shit so seriously. I was going to walk over to him and recommend his choice of Al-Shifa just to end the drama and ease this brewing family tension, when he got a faraway look, staring absolutely straight up, his hands extended outward, and I almost expected a huge gust of wind to lift him skyward. For a few moments of sheer, absolute hell, everything clicked. I knew this had been some ploy. I'd fallen for it. And I felt a kind of terror like acid intravenously pumped into my body. I knew, just knew, this was a suicide bombing. He was going to explode and this was it. And my whole fucking wasted 19-year-old nothing of a life was going to end in bits and pieces in this grocery store. And I thought of my little sister and brother and mom and dad, and the heat of tears felt appropriate, because I knew the true heat, the fireball, was imminent. Except it never came. The woman said something like Jido, which I looked up later, and I think it means grandpa in Arabic, but she said it still in a pedestrian, annoyed way, not the send-off for an Islamist terror attack. Like she was still in overwhelmed mom mode, trying to corral her kids and keep her baby from throwing his binky on the dirty ground. It was just so funny to me because, after realizing he wasn't going to blow up, I reverted instantly back to all the everyday annoyance thoughts. But I was still maybe the only one to realize that something fundamentally strange was going on with this older guy. I was going to alert everybody that he was having a stroke or something, although I have no idea what that would look like. It was all so fast that even trying to break it down is kind of dishonest. He lifted his hands up to the sky, brought his hands back to the top of his head, then his face, and then looked at his hands as if astonished, like it was the first time he was realizing he was a body with hands. And then he pushed those hands into his son's neck, pinning him against all those same honeys he spent so much time meticulously combing through, now all falling onto the floor. That detail struck me. The pointless bullshit he'd spent so much time on was pushed aside as, well, pointless bullshit. But now, that was considered a bad thing. I was surprised how effectively the old man had him pinned. The son was batting away at his hands, not too hard because it was still his father after all, or stepfather or whatever, still probably thinking it was all some misunderstanding. The little kid started crying, the older one yelling, "No!" and then, "You're not coming to my birthday party!" which in other circumstances would have been pretty funny. The old man was surprisingly unrelenting, and he and the son fell over, the grandpa on top and moaning something. I have no idea what, but whatever he was moaning, it was emphatic. He really meant it. A crowd gathered, including me, and we hoisted Grandpa off. I'll admit, I waited until some others took the lead. The crowd was still trying to be delicate, or as delicate as possible, with the old man. But there was definitely a mood change, something like a transition from confused sensitivity to hostility, when the old man's flailing knocked one of the kids over and he didn't notice or care. "Sir, get a hold of yourself," a customer commanded, a man who had grabbed the old man from behind. I remember thinking, "All right, family, now it's your job, take Grandpa home." But the son was still touching his neck in shock. The wife was yelling something in Arabic at her husband and the kids. And then the old man just started screaming, in a way I never heard before. It wasn't like a scream of pain or horror. It was something else, like a scream trying to transcend the limitations of existence and transform into something else entirely. And it wasn't stopping. An old man should not have the lung capacity for this, and there was an awkward moment where people almost started giggling, like this was a sketch in a movie where something goes from surprising to, okay, the joke's dead, to, okay, the joke's going on for so long now that it's kind of funny again. It was the way you might scream if you desired nothing more than escape and had no consideration for the limitations of your physical body. As he shifted his arms upward to the sky again, for a bizarre moment it looked to me like he was exultant for the honey on the top shelf, the scream became more recognizable as one of yearning, and he was so keenly focused, I somehow knew all was lost with him. Nothing could be or would ever be the same for him. Nothing in existence could ever properly address the anguish in that scream. Friends, family, hopes, dreams, even that honey he spent so much time selecting, all meant nothing. I turned and saw an older woman skewering her face with a boning knife. And like some mental defense mechanism, before I put all the pieces together of what I was watching, I thought, hey, that's Domingo's boning knife, the one with the black handle. Domingo worked in the butcher shop. He loved that knife. It's a narrow, thin, distinctive blade. And she was poking through her face, underneath the chin and upward. And in her grimacing face, I saw an anguish I can't describe. Not of pain, which I could generically say must have been unbearable, but that was literally not true since she was literally bearing it. She was the one persisting with it. It was her eyes. I saw a look like punishment for striving unfulfilled, like she was punishing herself somehow for her failures. It reminded me, and this doesn't make much sense, but like the frustration you feel when you've convinced yourself you can fix something, but you've just wasted all your time tinkering pointlessly and you've just admitted to yourself that it's time to call it and bring in a professional, or what I call a real person, to handle the problem. Frustration, futility, turning to self-hatred. How could I have known that, remembered that? I couldn't have. These must be retroactive tricks of memory. In my memory, it's frozen in one garish moment. The knife poking up through the chin, a freeze frame of her open mouth in a way I interpret as desperation and dissatisfaction. Nonsense, it must be. All panicked, bleary nonsense. But I know how I last saw her alive. Falling forward, still insensibly trying to carve more with her knife, like just one more prod in a different spot and the machine of her body would rev back to life, or something would change. Something meaningful would happen. The others saw this too, and I know they let the old Muslim man go. He must have been entirely forgotten. People were running, going crazy. I ran toward what must have been the dead woman, but stopped myself because I didn't want to see that up close. I remember the blood, how, insensibly, I thought it wasn't flowing as much as it should, wasn't staining everything like blood from a ruined face and neck should. Old person blood. Even their blood was slow-moving, lethargic. Down, 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 down in my subconscious. If the world was screaming at size 36 font with exclamation marks, in a size 4 footnote, I thought, clean up in the Mediterranean aisle. How terrible, I know. But maybe it was just to have my thoughts running. Maybe if I'm having a conversation with myself, things can't be that terrible. At this point, it was lunacy. I was running for Omar, and in the back of my mind, I caught myself thinking, how old is he? Relax, he's middle-aged. I saw him on the phone in the front, and he must have been unaware of the knife woman and maybe even the Muslim man, because I heard him calling the police about two other elderly people, and I could see who he was referring to. One older white man was on his knees, looking up at the sky, arms outstretched, eyes shut, mumbling something like, "Take me, please, please." But his pleases were desolate whimpers, the kind of begging that would go unmet just because it was too pathetic, and he clung to himself like a tantruming toddler. Another elderly South Asian-looking woman was banging on the windows near the exit that faced outside. That I didn't notice her at first was because her attempts were pretty feeble. I almost wanted to just point her to the automatic doors down the aisle, like maybe she was really just confused. "Omar, there's... I think she's dead. I mean, I know she's dead." I pointed to the Mediterranean aisle. And before he could think I was just adding something awful but different to the chaos he was already dealing with, I added, "She killed herself." And he solemnly said, "Shit." He knew, like I knew. This was all connected somehow. Screams and yells, and an elderly woman shuffled past, clutching something, followed by a furious roar of anger and outrage from the men and women behind her. "Give her back now!" a man screamed, and then I could see that the old woman was hobbling away with a baby in her arms. The old woman turned, and in that moment of separation, the baby pushed and squirmed. I saw its face, skin, beet red with impotent, eyes closed, lip quivering, crying. The old woman pressed the screaming infant to her body. A man barreled forward, and whatever head start the old woman had gotten was worth nothing. The distance between the pathetic crone and the crowd was closed before I took even a few steps. As the rightly furious man put a meaty hand where the woman's shoulder met her neck, I could fucking swear the old woman... I'm hoping she just licked the baby's face, but it looked more like an attempt to chew it. And where her mouth went, in some ungainly spot between the nose and an eye, well... it didn't look like a lick. Almost simultaneously, the South Asian woman yelled, "You leave her alone!" as the angry man grabbed what I assume was his daughter from the weak old woman and pushed her forward, where she toppled and fell under a sea of chips and snacks. Her fall was a rough one, seeming even more crazily brutal due to her age. You half expected her to hit the ground and just turn to dust. I saw the man give the South Asian woman, who yelled in support of the kidnapper, a bewildered, "Are you fucking kidding me?" look. And I saw that man was still someone who was still living in the normal world, responding to one discreet emergency, and hadn't yet connected all the dots to see pandemonium was erupting all around, was now the new way of life. Whatever drop of whatever had passed between that baby and the old woman's lips, she was rubbing, spreading, all over her face, her neck, her body, with an urgency that could only come just before imminent death. It reminded me somehow of how you take the sole remaining drip of shampoo and try to make it last by pouring water into the bottle. "Fucking psychopath!" The man stormed away, baby clutched to his shoulder, still inconsolable. The South Asian woman was back to banging on the window, but I could swear I saw the edge of her smile. Omar directed me to go to the back to get the first aid kits, but I don't even know if he knew what he was saying or if I heard him correctly. There were bawling screams coming from the Mediterranean aisle, and I could see the Arab family dragging a body and then crowding around in a buzzy, panicked way that let me know that Grandpa was dead. I kept charging to the back room. Shit was knocked over everywhere, people must have fled, and I can't blame them.
"Sir? Sir, he was attacking me, sir."
I heard a woman speak to me. It was a heavy African accent. It was like, "Sir, attacking me." She was speaking to me like I was an authority figure she needed to explain herself to. I saw she was wearing a kind of quasi-medical outfit that home health aides wear. And at her feet was a crumpled form that in a quick instance I could reconstruct. One of those doddering, skin-sack elderly types. The type that hobbles on a walker fixed to a breathing mask that makes you wonder, what do they do all day? How do they tolerate this? I gave her a look, the kind when someone asks you for directions and you want to express, "I wish I could help, but I'm a tourist here too."
"He didn't wait,"
an elderly white woman muttered pathetically. She was standing before the frozen meats, and her skin could have been made out of skinless chicken cutlets. She held a small knife and bizarrely, how could any thought be bizarre given all that was happening? I thought again of Domingo and wondered if something had happened to him. How did that first woman get the boning knife and now this? I didn't want to know right then. I just shook my head, if you can believe it. Of course, I was afraid. Anyone holding a knife in front of you is scary, but my nerves were shot. I couldn't just leave an old person out here with a knife. Who knows what the fuck she might do? But I wasn't going to risk grabbing it. I didn't know what to do. I don't know if she was plunging it into her own neck or she was just so uncoordinated she was planning on moving toward me with the knife, but I yelled, "No!" grabbed her wrist and uncorked the knife from her hand. I was only a big, tough, competent guy when I was manhandling the elderly. Her wrist felt so weak that I was almost positive I broke it or severely damaged it, like when you touch a rotting fruit and leave a permanent imprint. Like that rotten fruit, I half expected to feel sour juices seeping through the skin.
"No!"
she screamed back, hands to her face. Not in pain, but in frustration. She collapsed to the floor. I saw her wrist bent limply. I'd done some damage. She didn't seem to notice or care. Her pain was all extending upward.
"How do I? It's not fair,"
she mewled, with a passion I still could not associate with the elderly. I just ran back to the back room. Who knows how many crazy fucking tragedies had happened since Omar had ordered me, or maybe he didn't, to go to the back room. Who knows if he even cared, if he was even still here. There was wild shit going on all about me. I heard sirens, and there were flashing lights reflected through the windows, and too much to even mention. But I made it to the back room, and it was dark, and I half forgot what I was even doing back there, and I turned on a light, and I saw them in the blink of an eye. I think it was three of them, and I got bowled over by the first one. There was some hallucinatory second of calm where I knew I was interrupting whatever they were doing, and then they were fleeing in panic, and crazily enough, they were naked. One of the three shapes, the last to run out, had a distinctly slimmer female build, and I could see the roundness of the hips, and maybe this was me retroactively reimagining, but maybe the swing of her full breasts. When I think about it, and I do, often, I tell myself that's the one pleasant image from all this. Unexpected, nice, perky tits bouncing right past me. Did that happen? The first shape had shoved me hard enough to make me fall over, and they were all running together, but I couldn't tell you much else of what I saw. Except, I knew the following with a kind of comfortable certainty of a long-held belief. I knew that crumpled form with the walker, that he was dead, and that the woman I'd disarmed by the frozen meats, that she wasn't. That meant I'd seen three dead bodies. The Arab grandpa, the bone knife woman in the same aisle, the crumpled walker man. Three bodies, three forms rushing out. So what else is there to say, exactly? You know the rest. You're living it. Little kids don't have to endure the boredom and discomfort of a visit with their grandparents anymore. Heard about how many people in the old folks' homes and hospitals were euthanized? You wonder if their kids were just waiting for a goddamn excuse. This worldwide pandemonium worked for a lot of people tired of those Sunday visits to hospice. Imagine the inheritances that came early. But none of that's important. Before I go on, you should know I'm kind of a sentimental person. Timid, anxious, though I can hide it well. And also kind of a grandiose idiot, if all my attempts before at metaphors didn't clue you in. You could call me depressed, but I'd never admit it. I've stayed up late just losing myself online, obsessed with finding more versions of the type of sad, bittersweet music which I find strangely uplifting. Soon after I decided to take this gap year, I cried a few times listening to Mr. Jones by the Counting Crows, and if anyone ever learned about that, I'd have no choice but suicide. When he sings, "When everybody loves me, I will never be lonely." And when I look at the television, I want to see me staring right back at me. That shit hit deep. I get it. I was so far away from where I wanted to be, where I'd always envisioned myself, and I was never going to get there. I'm the type of person who has non-ironically closed his eyes meaningfully during parts of "I'd do anything for love, but I won't do that." So, take everything I say then with a grain of salt, I guess is what I'm saying. I have a tendency to over-romanticize or exaggerate, or maybe it's better to say I'm kind of a narcissistic over-emoter who wants to make myself seem more important than he is, or think things are more important than they actually are. But I always get back to thinking about what that first old man said to me, outside when I was collecting grocery carts. When that old man made it clear, consciously or not, that none of what you considered important throughout your life mattered at all when you were aged. Family, friends, memories, country, loyalty, patriotism, ethics. Nothing. Nothing mattered when you were... when you were what? Condemned to being old. What is it to be elderly, then? I hate to say it, but now I think it's like being trapped in a crumbling building with no hope of escape. I've heard people say, including middle-aged people, even older people, that they still feel young, think young, until they look in the mirror and are reminded otherwise. To think of yourself as the same person but trapped in a decaying body, and to be comforted by what? Clichés? To be surrounded by everyone else who doesn't get it, who can't possibly get it, and who, at base, are tired and, perhaps rightfully, repulsed by you, both as to what you are and what you represent? How do the elderly not grab every single person they see and yell, "Help me! Help me! I'm old! Do something! Don't you understand? I'm old! Help me!" I think it all started with that old man outside. I can't prove it, of course, but I've dedicated some online late-night sleuthing to my theory, and who knows what, but I did find, maybe this is real, maybe this isn't, a printout of 911 calls, and it looks to me like the first ones that came in reporting on what everyone assumed was happening everywhere all at once actually started around our area. For whatever that's worth. Who the fuck knows? Who the fuck cares, really? But I saw that first old man again that same day, not soon after I left that back room. I saw him out the front window just for a brief moment, arms out, face toward the sky. He was on the other side of the parking lot, but I could swear I saw him floating. There was a flurry of insane motion, like a tornado of black snakes thrashing underneath him. But again, he was far away. Maybe I didn't see what I thought I saw. I'll tell myself that. There was a throng of old people around him, which is funny to say, but it's true, and didn't seem too funny to me at the time. They weren't moving like elderly. They were stampeding, flailing. I distinctly saw someone drop to the ground, spin and crawl, but none of the others stopped, cared, or noticed, or acted like this wasn't anything other than what was expected. All part of the revelry. I can't describe it as a dance, but it was coordinated enough to conclude that the first old man from the parking lot was indisputably the centerpiece of the whole affair, with his crowd of grateful worshippers parading around him. I remember thinking about what he told me and realizing it wasn't just him going through that existential crisis. Maybe he was the first or the catalyst, but it had been all of them, likely having the same dread, the same thoughts. To think, all this bullshit, all this status anxiety and shame about not going to real college and taking time off, and this menial job, and what will people think of me, and if I'm so smart, why do I work in a grocery store? And all this, and these are the good times, because I'm not yet elderly and wretched. That's the word. To be wretched, through no fault of your own. You survive long enough, and your prize is to become helpless, hopeless, and wretched. That's what he'd been when I saw him on the corner. Desperate. Wretched. And I can't prove it. Who can? But he was grappling with something, some knowledge that he could save himself, save all of them from that fate. And he'd made the plunge to go forward with it. And what I'd like to imagine that I could see in the details of his face, a kind of ecstatic, almost aggressive peace and contentment, one I'd never known existed. And amazingly, there's nothing before or since then that's ever convinced me so thoroughly that there must be a God, or at least something like a God, that is out there and loves us and looks out for us. Or at least, looks out for some of us. And that man found it, called out to him, and it listened. You've been listening to Love is Not an Eternal Thing Like Hatred or Disgust by J.R. Hamantaschen. J.R. Hamantaschen is a writer of short stories, having released several collections, including A Deep Horror That Was Very Nearly Awe, with a voice that is often still confused but is becoming ever louder and clearer, and You Shall Never Know Security. You can find collections of his work at Velux Books, www.veloxbooks.com. Well, friends, somehow this grim season has gotten even grimmer. Is that a word? Screw it, it is now. I'll be signing off shortly to continue my temporary love affair with Benadryl. But first, I'd like to thank JR for the story tonight. In fact, we have some more material of his that we'll be presenting in the coming weeks, so buckle up, kiddos. In the meantime, thank you all for joining me tonight on the frozen, windswept Horror Hill. And until next week, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot, and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com, and we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.